Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're very honoured and delighted to have Sir Harold Bishop to give this lecture on 40 years of broadcast engineering. Sir Harold's career in the BBC spanned a period from 1923 to 1963, exactly 40 years in point of fact. He was educated at Allain School and the City and Guilds College. He worked initially in the Office of Works and then in Marconi's, and he joined the BBC, as I say, in 1923 as Senior Superintendent Engineer. He was subsequently Assistant Chief Engineer from 1929, Chief Engineer from 1943, and Director of Engineering from 1952. From this you'll see that he was in fact a senior member of engineering management for this whole period of 40 years, which I imagine must be a pretty unique record. He was awarded CBE in 1938 and was knighted in 1955. I'm quite sure you'll gather from this that there's no one better fitted to talk on this subject, and I have great pleasure in asking Sir Harold to give us his talk.
I ought to say, Mr. Sturge, that you say I was Senior Superintendent Engineer in 1923. I ought to make it clear there wasn't an awful lot to be Superintendent Engineer of at that time. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I had a number of doubts about accepting this kind invitation of yours, because the history of the BBC is pretty well known these days, and I see before me certain gentlemen who have been studying this matter for the last 2 or 3 years and probably know a good deal more about it than I do. So if they all go to sleep or walk out or heckle me, I shall know that I've said something wrong. But I did in fact, I looked it up last night, talk to this society on the 6th of January 1959. And in fact, I gave a talk which was similar in a way to the one I'm going to inflict upon you this evening. But perhaps certain things have happened since then, and I can add it. But repetition of these historical matters, of course, does become rather boring. But nevertheless, I am most appreciative of your invitation, and I hope that some of the things that I say may be of interest to you. Another thing I did last night, because I had forgotten it, was to play the record, which I found I had, by the way, of Captain Eckersley's talk to you in 1960. Most amusing talk, and of course I shan't compare with that, and I can't compete with it. But it was a very interesting talk, and some of you here may have been present on that occasion 10 years ago. I understand that Sir Noel Ashbridge was asked to talk to you round about now, to talk about the time that he was chief engineer from 1929 to 1952, but because of he doesn't go out as much as he used to do, I think he refused your invitation. So in fact, what I'm going to try and do, if I may, is to cover not only his time from 29 to 52 when he was the boss and I was number two, but also of course my own time of 11 years from 1952 until 1963. Well, I understand that, in fact I know, of course, that you are writing this engineering history, and I hope and sincerely trust that it will be complete and published and printed by the time of your Golden Jubilee in 1972. I think it's terribly important that the engineering story should be read, should be available in printed form by that date, because in spite of the really magnificent job which Professor Asa Briggs has done in the three books which have been published so far, it did seem to me, without any reflection on him, of course, that the engineering story in those three books was perhaps a little bit inadequate. And I hope that the new book, when it is published, and I hope it will be published, will be an interesting, and in fact, obviously will be an interesting story of engineering events. Now, it's not for me to judge whether the engineering story is in fact interesting and progressed in a remarkable way, but I think you'll agree that many things were done in those early years which were of interest, because we were not selling or making a profit or doing anything like that, but we were providing a public service in the full glare full glare of public comment and criticism. And I think it's interesting that the motivating force behind all this, and indeed behind the work that you are now doing in the BBC, is a public service. And it's always worthy, I think, of study of the sort of things which get people going in those circumstances. It's not better than or different from the motivating force of industry. I've seen both since I've left the BBC, but it just is different, and it's a thing worthy of study. Well, I'm not here to philosophize about things like that, but to give some account, if I may, of BBC engineering in this period in which I've been concerned, from 1923 to 1963. I hope you won't expect a precise and coherent story, because it's very difficult to get a thing like this into perspective. The period of 40 years does, of course, as you well know, divide itself really into four parts. One is the company days up till 1927. The second is the pre-war corporation from 1927 to 1939. The third is the wartime period. And, of course, the fourth is the post-war. And the next Briggs book, I suppose, will cover the wartime period. I'm not quite sure how long it will be, up to 1955, is it? Something like that. But that will be 2 or 3 years before it's out, I believe. Well, so far as my own career is concerned, you heard Mr. Searle say that I was in the Marconi Company. I was, in fact, there in 1922, and I was in the power test at Chelmsford, testing spark transmitters, quarter kilowatt spark transmitters, which seems a little elderly in these days. And then, for some reason best known to Marconi's and not to me, I was transferred to C.S. Franklin's staff. You remember C.S. Franklin, who did all the work on beam aerials? Well, he had an independent research department at Marconi's, which was separate from the research department under Captain Round, because those two couldn't agree, so they had two separate divisions. And another reason, for other reasons which I don't understand, it was Franklin's job to look after 2LO in Marconi House, which had been built out of bits and pieces in the middle of 1922 and had done certain experimental transmissions from that time on. Well, I was one of the small boys, or three of us in all, who was sent up to Marconi House in January 1923 to run this transmitter. And that I did, and as you well know, the transmissions from the BBC started on the 14th of November 1922, and we looked after that transmitter until the BBC gradually growing, Eckersley having been appointed in February 1923, and I transferred to, being very young and foolish and not knowing really what the BBC was, I transferred to the BBC on the 10th of May, 1923. And that's how I became to retire exactly 40 years later. So I had 40 years of fairly considerable activity. Well, going back a bit, and again, I apologize to some of you people here who know, as I say, as much as this as I do, you will remember that the telephony experiments which Marconi did in 1919-20 were of quite considerable importance. They were done by Round and his second in command, W.T. Ditcham, whom I knew very well. And the pressure after those transmissions of 20, the pressure of the telephony programs for wireless amateurs and receiver manufacturers was quite considerable. And because of Marconi initiative, Eckersley started up, as you well know, two amateur talk at Ripple in 1922. And they did half an hour programs every week until early in 1923. And the transmitter in Broadcasting House, which, as I say, was started in the middle of 22, started the regular programs from the studio there in Marconi House in November 1922. And the experimental transmissions at that time, as Eckersley said very clearly in his lecture 10 years ago, were under the control of Arthur Burrows, who had the title of chief of the demonstration department of Marconi's at that time. Well, again, this is old history and you know it. There were negotiations between industry and the Postmaster General leading to the formation of the British Broadcasting Company Limited. I'm not going to go into those details because I think they're well known. But the capital of the company, you may remember, was £100,000, of which some £60,000 was supplied by six major manufacturers, and something like £12,000 by smaller manufacturers of receiving sets. And as I say, the programs from 2LO started regularly on the 14th of November 1922. And the amateur use, the amateurs were rather annoyed about this, but the amateur use of 440 meters, which was their province at that time, was stopped by the start of broadcasting. And the original program, the first program of November the 14th, comprised two news bulletins and a weather report. Well, coming back just 1 month before that, in October 1922, the question of the license is a very complicated story, and again, I'm not going to harass you with a lot of details. But there were, in fact, two licenses, the experimental and the broadcast license, and the reason for that was that under the experimental license, you could make your own sets and oscillate and do all sorts of nasty things, and the broadcast license you could not, because you had to use approved apparatus. And therefore the thing was split for the sole reason of reducing oscillation, and I suppose to some extent it did achieve that. Well, the early success of broadcasting, the astonishment in which it met everywhere, needed a very early review, in fact less than 9 months after we'd started, to sort out the financial problems. And there was a committee called the Sykes Committee which proposed that some 75% of the license money should be given to the BBC. And the experimental license, remember, paid nothing to the BBC, it was only the broadcast license. So they had a new license called the constructor's license, for which we paid 15 shillings, and part of that was given to the BBC, and that was free of restrictions and permission to accept free restrictions on the use of the set. And in addition, as a result of the Sykes thing, and this is a very interesting point, the BBC were given permission to accept programs provided by outsiders, in other words, they advertised programs. And I well remember in Savoy Hill, as it then was, had become by that time, programs supplied by, in particular one I remember, by the Daily Express, and of course there was advertising of the Daily Express in that program. But the whole thing of advertised programs was allowed quietly to die, and in fact the whole idea was waived, finished in 1925. And the dependence upon revenue, set royalty revenue, which we were very much dependent on in the first 2 years, from industry, that also ceased in 1924. So we got a fairly tidy situation from 1925 onwards. Well, again, the first transmitter plan, as you may remember, consisted of 8 1.5 kilowatt sets, and they were completed in 1923, and then in 1924 we added another one in Belfast. Of course, the early receivers, as you may, some of you remember, were terribly insensitive and unsatisfactory in many ways. And there was, of course, this need for improved coverage, which Eckersley mentioned so clearly and so adequately in his lecture. And we put up in 1924, and here's a point which I think I disagree with Lord Reith, because in the epilogue to Eckersley's lecture, he said that the money that we got, the additional money that we got, because we put up these 12 low-power stations in 1924, didn't really help the BBC's finance. Well, I think it did. I think that when we put these stations up at the rate of one a month in 1924, there was a very considerable increase in our license revenue. And that was a quite appreciable importance at that time, because we were jolly hard up. But there was this need for improved coverage, and these 12 low-power relays, of which Sheffield was the first in 1923, were very important. They all did separate programs, of course, because there was very little SB at that time. Then, round about the same time, I'm talking 1923 now, was published the first edition of the Radio Times on the 28th of September 1923. I've got a copy of it here if anybody wants to look at it afterwards. The next, I think, important thing I want to mention is Eckersley's advocacy of long waves. Those of you who heard him talk will remember that he got this idea from his brother, Tom Eckersley, who was a a scientist of no mean order. And Eckersley got the idea that what was really wanted to cover the country was a long-wave transmitter. And he arranged with Marconi's for Chelmsford transmissions with an experimental transmitter in mid-1924, and the results were very satisfactory. So we had this decision in November 1924 to build a long-wave station, and the choice of the site was, of course, Daventry. You may ask, why Daventry? Well, I remember we sent Leslie William Hayes, whom many of you will know, we sent him out in his Morris Cowley motor car to find a site for Daventry. And he went round after looking at the map to the highest point in the middle of England, which was Daventry, the Borough Hill, and that was the site we chose. And it's a very good site. And we started building there in November 24, and it opened in July 1925. We didn't take long to build stations in those days. We're a bit slower these days, of course. Well, the aerial fell down quite soon after we opened, but that didn't deter us. We put it up again, and all was well. And the station served, on the basis of our calculations at that time, whether they're really true now, I don't know, was said to be 55%. So we had a total service then with the medium wave stations of 80%, which wasn't going too badly at that time. And we changed from Marconi House, where we were really a bit of a nuisance. Marconi's didn't want us to stay there. It really wasn't big enough. It was quite absurdly small. And we built a transmitter on the top of Selfridge's roof, which was quite an achievement in a way. We got hold of a man called Bylander, who was the consulting engineer who had built the Selfridge building in, 1910, 1912, something like that. And he knew all about the steelwork. And he knew that we could put up a couple of 125-foot masts onto the actual steelwork of the Selfridge building. And had it not been for him, I doubt very much whether we could have done it. And in order to stop any jealousy between Selfridges and Harrods, I well remember going to Harrods, not wanting to go to their site at all, but seeing Sir Richard Burbage, who was the head of Harrods at that time, and telling him what we wanted, and then coming away and not doing anything about it. And so we managed to get this transmitter on Selfridges, and again, it was twice the power, it was 3 kilowatts, and it didn't do a bad job. After, that was in 1925, and after the end of 1925, I think it's fair to say that we had a pause in our transmitter construction. We got things going pretty well, we got this coverage of 80% or even more, and it wasn't too bad. Well, as I say, in 1925, the company was operating almost, in spite of it being a limited company, it was operating almost purely and simply as a public service, and as it said at the time, to the satisfaction of all concerned. That's a quotation from a document at that time. And in fact, it's interesting to note that the criticism of the monopolistic character of the BBC had in fact almost entirely disappeared. I think that's a feather in the BBC's cap at that time. And as a result of that, the new committee which the government set up, the Crawford Committee, recommended in 1925 to adopt a centralised control in the hands of a disinterested body. Again, I'm quoting the words of the report. And as a result of that, the winding up of the company with the end of 1926 and the constitution of a public authority, the corporation, that came into operation from the 1st of January 1927. And that, again, I think is an interesting fact, because that was Britain's first public utility, if that's the right word, public corporation, which was followed, of course, by the Electricity Commission and the gas industry and all the rest of it, which we know about. But I think the BBC Corporation in 1927 was the first of that kind, working, as you know, under a royal charter. Shows so much for the forward-looking attitude of Lord Reith, or Sir John Reith as he then was, that this was happening as it did. Well, in view of all this and all the things that we were doing, the early emergence of wavelength problems of broadcasting, as broadcasting developed in Europe, was a thing which gave us quite a headache even in those days. And as you've known, it's giving you a much greater headache now. And that was the principal reason for the formation of the Union Internationale de Radiophonie, as it originally was, and that last word was later changed to Radiodiffusion, in 1925. The first meeting was held in London here under Admiral Carpendale, and again I have interesting memories of that meeting. It's well to remember too that the whole impetus behind this international situation really arose from Eckersley and what Eckersley was doing, and a tremendous debt was owed to him for all that kind of work. And the first thing that the UIR did was, of course, to form a technical committee to study this wavelength problem. And as a result of that, the first wavelength plan in Europe, the Plan de Genève in 1926, was formed. And I think there were, how many waves? 83 exclusive waves and 16 shared medium waves, of which we had, if I remember rightly, 13. And of course, there was no long wave plan in those days, because there weren't any long wave stations except one or two. And following all that really pioneering work in the international sphere, there was the ITU conference in Washington in 1927, which Eckersley attended as the representative of the UIR, and got the needs of broadcasting well in front of the international body. Briefly, turning now to microphones and amplifiers, I haven't got the time, and I really, it's very difficult to summarize this, and I'm not going to say very much about it. But the progress was tremendously rapid. Program control. I well remember Round, who was a very great man. You'll remember his was the original reaction patent of 1913 or thereabouts. And he got tremendously interested in the microphone problem in the Marconi House days of 1923. And I well remember playing notes of the piano for hours on end while he listened to the microphone which he had developed. And then suddenly the Rice microphone turned up. Rice himself turned up from Germany. And Round realized that this was a much better microphone than his. And that was the sort of steady development which started the steady development of microphones, amplifiers, and all the rest of it, which you are well aware of. It's interesting to remember, too, the starting of SB. It started in Marconi House in the early months of 1923 by the Western Electric Company, the forerunners of standard telephones. And it was done by E.K. Sanderman, who will be well known to many of you because he came to the BBC later, and a man called A. Thompson, who was responsible for the work. And they put in amplifiers in Marconi House, and using the open wire circuits of the post office, we got SB to Leeds and beyond. There were many confusing moments on the program side because of that work. The amount of SB at that time was really quite small, but it was a thing which we established, and everybody thought it was quite remarkable at the time. On outside broadcasts, I am rather proud of the fact that I was the first one to broadcast dance bands from the Savoy. One of these silly things that one remembers, of the two dance bands, you remember the Savoy Orpheans and the Savoy Havana bands, which were the very famous bands of London at that time, in 1923, and the first time it was my job, and I took these amplifiers in there, and we broadcast for the first time, much to the amazement of all the very superior people who occupied the Savoy at that time. Then we had, I remember very well, but I can't remember the name of the chap, a political communist speech from the Kingsway Hall. This was before I came to the BBC. It was in my Marconi House days in the early months of 1923. I think we had a communist MP at that time, and I think his name was Newbrough, and I'm not quite sure about that. But for some obscure reason I never understood, we broadcast his speech from the Kingsway Hall. And then, of course, we had opera from Covent Garden, which was a tremendous thing. And then just one other I want to mention is the opening of the Wembley exhibition by George V in April 1924. That was a great occasion because it was the first time that we'd had royalty at the microphone. And I remember Kirk was in the arena just under the microphone in a rather unpleasant conditions. And the man in charge of the little building we had outside the arena was J. Partridge, and I was there with him at this control point. Anyway, it all went well, and everything in the garden was lovely, and the BBC got quite a number of good marks for doing what it did. One other thing I want to mention, and that is the Greenwich time signal. I expect some of you know this, but perhaps not all, but it started from a suggestion by Frank Hope Jones, who was a chap who ran the Synchronome Clock Company. And he and I went down to Greenwich one day to see Sir Frank Dyson, who was then the Astronomer Royal, and we arranged with him at Hope Jones's suggestion that we should put out the Greenwich time signal, and that's how it started, and that's how it's been going on ever since. Turning now to the concept of empire broadcasting. It's interesting to remember that when that was first discussed in 1926-27, the sort of things that were talked about was, and I quote, establishing reciprocal contact over continents and oceans. Well, that hasn't quite happened, not the reciprocal contact part. At any rate, it didn't happen for a long time. And then, again quoting, linking together of national systems for the benefit of the ordinary listener. That's the way the Empire Service started when we started our experiments in 1927. And the BBC thought it had a duty to establish this service. And because of that, we arranged these experimental shortwave transmissions from Chelmsford in 1927 on 25.53 metres. And they were very successful. And as a result of that, I remember going to both the colonial and the imperial conferences, committees of them, with Lord Reith, Mr. Reith as he then was, no, Sir John Reith he was then, and discussing with them what we might do and asking them for money. Well, that was all very well, but no money was forthcoming, not one single penny, and from any of the dominions or colonies for a shortwave empire service. And we had naturally to be cautious about the results that we expected from this service. We knew very well the failings and shortcomings of short waves, and we couldn't guarantee these things. And as a result, we got no money at all. And then Reith made one of these major decisions, which he did in his lifetime. He decided to go ahead and build the station at the BBC's expense. And that is what happened, as you may know. And in 1931, in November 1931, that decision was made. The financial difficulties, and I often remember we were jolly hard up at the time, the financial difficulties were ignored. And I believe that was a very brave act to do at that time, if you cast your mind back to the sort of things we were talking about 40 years ago. And as a result of that, we had discussions with Standards and Marconi's, and finally finished up by placing an order with Standards for two transmitters, S1 and S2, at Daventry. And the chap, of course, who did it in Standards is still there, Spagnoletti, and he was responsible for the design of the station. Two 15-kilowatt sets, which were opened in 1932. And you'll remember, too, that the Empire was divided into five zones, each zone being provided with a directional aerial system, very broad beams, in order to give a service as best we could. And the whole thing was fairly successful, but it would be unwise and incorrect to say more than that. There was quite a lot of criticism about the bad results in long distances, which, of course, to an engineer were well known and to be expected. And then in 1937, we put in a new transmitter building with four 50-kilowatt transmitters. One other thing of the early days I want to mention is the general strike of 1926. Some of you may be too young to remember that, but it really wasn't an extraordinary occasion. And I believe that in those very early days, the things that the BBC did at that general strike brought to people the importance of broadcasting as a national service. It emphasized the value of broadcasting. There were no newspapers, as you will remember, except the British Gazette, of which I still have a copy. And it was quite important. It only lasted a week or so, and the BBC really did a good job. And another thing we did at that time was to augment the medium wave and long wave. We thought it would be a good idea if we did some transmission tests on ultra-short waves, or 7 meters to be precise, which we did from a transmitter in this building, and I imagine it's been move many years since, and those took place in 1932. Of course, it only had a small coverage, and in fact the experiments were not pursued. But it was an idea we had at that time, even in those very early days, that we might use UHF for improving our coverage. Well, coming now to a little bit further on, Eckersley's plan, which did actually goes back to 1925, for higher power twin transmitter regional stations will be known to you all, and I'm not going into any details of that. He did in fact first moot that plan as a result of discussions with his brother as to the feasibility of doing it in 1925. And we had, as many of you will remember, tremendous opposition from the post office because of the likely expected reception difficulties of picking out one station from another, two stations on the one side, with the sort of crystal sets and so on which were in use at that time. But we felt it was a go, and we charged ahead, and eventually we got approval from the post office to start an experimental station 5GB at Daventry in 1927. And here I want to pay tribute to the work which McClarty did at that station at that time. He built up the whole thing. He was an experimental transmitter, of course, and really made it work, and the results were of great importance to our subsequent work. I mentioned 5GB as being the forerunner of the regional scheme, and I would also like to mention the Eccles Committee of 1927, which was a committee set up under the chairmanship of Dr. W.H. Eccles, who was a very famous chap, and in fact only died a few years ago at the age of about 95, past president of the IEEE. And he and E.V. Appleton, as he then was, Professor Appleton, and L.B. Turner from Cambridge, with Roland Wynne as secretary, were a committee to study our plans for regional transmitters. And they gave us their full support. And the minutes of that meeting I passed to Mr. Turner about a year ago. It should be in your archives. Anyway, we got full approval for our plans, and they were approved by the post office after the flat disapproval, or whatever the right word is, of a year or so before. And then Brookmans Park, which you know about, of course, was built by 1929. I think the interesting thing about what I've said so far, all these activities and things were plans were going on at the same time. We had no precedents for the work we were doing, and very little money, although we got by. And we managed to do these things in the way that we did, I think by a cooperative effort amongst all the people concerned. Then, of course, we had the resignation of Eckersley in 1929, which was a sad thing, but then the appointment of Sir Noel Ashbridge in 1929 to take his place, and we proceeded under Ashbridge from then on. And the station building program of 1930 to 1939, the beginning of the war, I won't bother you with, except to mention that there were five twin transmitters, four single transmitters, and a number of low power stations. All that went on in those years of the 30s. The problem of wavelength shortage continued to be a pain in the neck to us. You will remember the Lucerne plan of 1934. I have a copy of it here if anybody wants to see it. And then there was a Madrid plan of 1940, which never became operative because of the beginning of the war. The work of the UIR in all those years was really quite outstanding. And it really is of interest, I think, that in those days, all this wavelength work, and I think Mr. Pawley will agree, was done very largely by the UIR and not by the post office. Things are a bit different these days, I think. But in those days, the post office really were on the sidelines. And the UIR were doing this work for the whole of Europe, and I believe doing it very well. Broadcasting House. Well, we're in it, so there it is. The design and the construction, largely due to Cloudesbury and the architect to the financial syndicate from whom we leased the site, Colonel Valmar. It is of interest to mention that when Tudsbury was looking for a site, he was instructed to do so by Reith, when he was looking for a site to replace Savoy Hill, this was one, of course, which was the site of Foley House, In fact, there were two Foley houses, but the one, the Foley house which was pulled down, was going to be pulled down, and was going to have a block of offices or flats built in this, on this site. And we managed to get it in time when we took a lease of it, a building lease, and this building was built as a result of that. But it is worth remembering that there are many, many others were considered at that time, amongst which one most important was the site of Dorchester House, where the Dorchester Hotel now is. Dorchester House was, of course, one of the grand mansions of London, and it was our idea at that time to use the Dorchester House as it was, a magnificent mansion, and to build behind it in the garden. Well, it didn't come off. It was a bit expensive and didn't have the advantages that this site did. There were many others. The Adelphi was another. Bush House was another. I can't think. There were half a dozen of them which we thought of at that time. But eventually this was chosen. And we leased this site, and we didn't buy it until 1936. And the original proposal was to have offices up top, offices and studios up on the top, and to let out the ground floor for shops. Well, I'm glad to say that never happened. And we moved from Savoy Hill on the 14th of May, 1932. And we had a visit from George V and Queen Mary on the 7th of July, 1932. I'm going to turn now quickly to television. This, really, the story about that goes back to 1926, because in that year we had discussions with Baird, who was playing about in his experimental attic in Longacre on a mechanical system. And as a result of that, we really were rather worried about it, because we didn't think it had any future, but nevertheless we didn't want to disregard it. And remember that we were pretty new to the game anyway. But we did finally decide, after quite a lot of chatter, in fact, chatter which went on for 3 years, experimental transmissions on 30 lines and 12 and a half pictures a second in September 1929. And they were transmitted, of course, through Brooklands Park. And really, they were of little value. We did a Derby transmission in 1931 of the winning post, and again in 32. And then in 32, we took over the transmission program side, and as some of you may remember, we had a transmitter in the basement here, BA or BB, BB I think it was, which was used for the 30-line transmission with a Nipkow disc, of course. And Bridgewater and Birkinshaw and Campbell were the three chaps who were very closely concerned with that work. But as I say, the whole thing was to us unsatisfactory. We had a considerable dissatisfaction with the results. No receivers were sold. It obviously had no future, and we didn't really know what to do about it. You remember that there had to be a white sheet behind the artist, and the artist had to have a dead white skin, and there was one wavelength for vision and another for sound, and the people that allegedly looked at these things were all called lookers and not viewers in those days. And really, it was a dead loss. It was costing a certain amount of money, and we didn't really know what to do about it. But then, another thing we did at that time, also in 1929, was to transmit still pictures by a process called the photograph, which was a very simple picture transmission process, suggested to us by a man called Fulton. That was very short-lived indeed. Well, then we were saved because of the development of a high-definition system. And the high-definition experiments, both by Baird and by more particularly by Marconi EMI, and we did those experiments from the UHF transmitter, the 7-meter transmitter, which I've already mentioned. And those were done in 1932-33. And demonstrations were given of these obviously much improved systems by both Baird and Marconi EMI. Then we had the problem, well, this is all very well, this has obviously got a future, but should a service be established? Well, we obviously couldn't make that decision ourselves, and the government set up the Selsdon Committee of 1934, which reported, and I quote, "Research has reached such a stage that a regular service of high-definition television could be contemplated." and the station to be established in London to examine under service conditions the relative merits of the two systems. Well, that was the indication we had to get on with the job. So we looked around, all this came out of our own money, of course, and we considered possibly Alexandra Palace and Crystal Palace. We didn't go to Crystal Palace because Baird was already there, and we thought it was just as well to be away from there. So we went to Alexandra Palace, which was roughly the same height as Crystal Palace on the other side of London. And there, as you many will know, we set up the first London station and did our first transmissions with Baird's on 240 lines, 25 pictures a second, and a frequency band, I suppose, of about a megacycle, and Marconi EMI on 405 lines and 25 pictures a second. Also, it is alleged it was a frequency band of one megacycle. It may have been more. Interlaced scanning, of course. And there were two vision transmitters, one for each, and one sound transmitter. And as you well know, the Marconi EMI system, using the Emitron, as it was then called, under the inspired genius, and I use those words advisedly, of Isaac Schoenberg and his two chaps, Blumlein and Brown, both of whom were killed in the war, produced the Marconi EMI system, which was far better, far, far better than the Baird system, and it gave most encouraging results. The Baird intermediate film system on a 17.5 millimeter film, which developed, you remember, in 65 seconds, and is scanned by an evacuated disc at 6,000 revs per minute. Well, it was very interesting, but it didn't hold a candle to the Marconi EMI results. However, Baird also had, of course, the Farnsworth camera, which, as far as I can remember, and some of you may know more of this than I do, was never really got off the ground. It was never successful. Well, we started the transmissions in Radio Olympia on August the 26, 1936, and then a service on November the 2nd, 1936. And each system had 1 week each, which was a quite crazy situation, but it was the thing we had to do. But it was a foregone conclusion what the result would be, and the EMI system won, as we knew, and was used as the only system from the 8th of February, 1937. So there we are. That's how the thing started at Alexandra Palace, and we had the benefit of the EMI system, which I think, I'm sure you'll agree, that having regard to the state of the electronic art at that time, was really quite outstanding. Remember that all the tremendous advantages of wartime, radar and so on, had not at that time happened. And the work which Blumlein and Brown did on the EMI system, I think, was terrific. Well, we closed down, of course, in 1939, 1st of September, and it was reopened in the 6th of June, 1946, when new stations were built to give national coverage. But it is worth remembering the Hanke report, which was in the middle of the war. The committee under Lord Hanke, set up by the post office, of course, reported in 1943. And they said that the service, when the war was over, should start again on 405 lines, but that there should be research on an improved system. Improved. They didn't specify particularly what they meant by that. I have a copy of that report if anybody's interested in it. Shadows of War. I just don't want to say something about that. It's interesting that in 1935 we had a request from Watson Watt in great secrecy to provide us with staff for the work that he was doing at Bordsey, which led, of course, to radiolocation, as it was then called, later radar. I can't remember how many and who went to Bordsey at that time. There were a number went from research, but I can't give you any names. But that, of course, was the beginning of the radar plan, which Watson Watt was very largely responsible for. Then in 1936, we started discussions with the Air Ministry and the Committee of Imperial Defense on what would happen if war came and what would happen to broadcasting. And in 1937, the Home Office said, we must have broadcasting in wartime and we must have it during an air raid, if there are going to be air raids. So we said, all right, we'll try and think of a scheme which works satisfactorily, and which gets over the difficulties which the Air Ministry had, the RAF had, with the problem of direction finding on our stations. So we prepared three schemes of one, two, and three alternate groups of stations working on the same frequency. Well, the Air Ministry looked at all this, and all the schemes were found to be unacceptable to them. But if they agreed that if broadcasting was to continue, which is what the Home Office said, then the best scheme was to have two groups and closing down the dangerous stations. Well, we suggested in June 38 an alternative scheme of mobile transmitters, and that was not accepted. But it was later agreed that as an adjunct to the synchronized scheme to avoid closing down in air raids. Well, it's interesting that as late as June 1938, the government was seriously thinking that it might have to stop broadcasting altogether in wartime. And it was not until July 1938 that our scheme of two groups of medium wave transmitters, each synchronized on a single wavelength, with a proviso that any or all might have to be closed down on orders from Fighter Command, was accepted. A lot of that detail work at that time was done by Martin Pulling, I remember, who was at that time an assistant to me. Droitwich Long Wave, of course, we had to close on Air Ministry instructions, but it resumed as a group with Daventry and Brookmans Park in November 1941 when the air raid business had died off to some extent. And that, of course, was of tremendous value in improving reception in Europe at that time. Well, I think the synchronized scheme, very simple as we see it now, it really was a tremendous success. And only once in the whole of the war were all the transmitters closed simultaneously. And that was a very sharp contrast with Germany, who were often all their stations were off the air. And we know from captured documents that the scheme really did work, and the Germans couldn't use it for direction-finding purposes. So it was a basically simple, very simple indeed in our present thinking, but a highly effective scheme, which of course required the development of crystal drives, which Varley was very much concerned with at that time, to permit the close synchronization with outline links, which was essential to the scheme. So it all worked out well, and it was completed and in operation by the 1st of September 1939. I was going to mention that we, in order to improve the coverage, we built, you remember, the H group of 60 low-power transmitters, which only closed down when there was a local alert in the town in which they were situated. So we had severe strains on our system during the war, but I think we ought to be proud of the fact that it never really broke down. And I was chairman of a thing called the Defence Subcommittee, which did quite a lot of work both before and during the war, and we decided before the war that a battle headquarters outside London, I'm quoting, is essential and should be obtained as soon as possible. That was in June 1939. As a result of that, we got Wood Norton. I want to mention, too, in connection with our war effort, Optringham, which really was quite a remarkable station. It's disappeared now. It was largely the work of McNamara, and it was built in 1942 with four 200-kilowatt transmitters, the idea being that we were going to put a daylight service into Berlin, and indeed we achieved that. And it was both long wave and medium waves. It was really an outstanding station, but of course, as far as peacetime was concerned, it was in the wrong place and we couldn't use it. Just mention very briefly the Empire Station, that we put up three shortwave stations and three high-power transmitters added to Daventry during the war. We finished up with 36 transmitters. 150 wartime studios, continuity, which Roland Wynne was very much concerned with. And we did a tremendous lot in helping government departments and the fighting services in their various wartime activities. I mention also quickly the monitoring service and the staff training that we did, both beginning at the and during the war, to get over our staff problems. Recording. I'm not going to say too much about this because the story has been written, I've just read it actually, by Peter West as part of the business of getting all this information together. He's written the most interesting story about it, and I hope some in due course it will be published. It starts from 1925 when Hayes and I went to Berlin to see the Stiller wire system. And we looked at it. It had been produced as an office dictating system at that time. The original Poulsen wire device of, 1912, something like that, had been adopted for this purpose. And there was a very urgent need for a recording system, particularly, of course, for the Empire Service. So a great deal was done in the development of the Blattner phone in 1930, and then through the 30s. But it's interesting that the disc system won the day during the war. I think we were a little slow about this. I don't quite know why it went that way. We got tremendous value out of the Watts recording system, which Watts himself produced in 1928. And because of the developments there, that seemed to take first place rather than the tape system, which later came predominant. Whether you still do any disc recording, I don't know. I imagine not, do you? Is there any disc recording still going on?
Not
really. No. And then, of course, we had the Phillips Miller system, which was very good indeed, but rather expensive, and it didn't last. It lasted up to the war and during the war, but no further. Just a note about the return to peacetime working. We had more radio programs, as you remember, and the restarting of television, which I've already mentioned, in 1946. And the formation of the UER in 1950, the UIR having been dissolved during the war, just disintegrated, a new body was started, the UER in 1950, for which Mr. Pawley has done so much on the technical committee in the last, 10, 11, 12 years, whatever it is. 18 years, good gracious. He has been the mainstay of the technical committee, which has done a tremendous amount of work. And I think the BBC should be jolly grateful to him for all the things that he's done. And then, of course, because we were so short of wavelengths, we looked into the problems of propagation characteristics from transmitters at AP for UHF, VHF, I beg your pardon. And we decided to build Rutum in 1947. And there's an interesting story there, a very simple one, but... We had great arguments, I remember, Ashbridge, Kirk, Clark himself and others, as to whether we should adopt FM or AM at that time. And we all thought that FM was right. But Ashbridge was absolutely adamant that we had to put in two transmitters, one FM and one AM, in order to be absolutely sure that we were doing the right thing. And in fact, that's what happened, as you know. We put in two transmitters, a 25 kilowatt FM and an 18 kilowatt AM, and the results of the original tests we did there indicated that FM was the right choice, and the post office supported us. And then as a result of that, we built the VHF chain. And I, so far as I'm concerned, I was very disappointed at the receiver situation. It may be better now. I don't know how many are sold these days. But we were disappointed that it didn't catch on more quickly. May I mention very briefly the Commonwealth broadcasting conferences, which have really brought together the whole of the empires the Commonwealth, rather, and have done a great deal of good. We had the two conferences to start with in London in 1945, with bombs dropping all around in March 45, and then another one in London in 52, in Australia in 56, and India in 60. That was my period, and then, of course, there have been others since then. And the technical work, I think, has been very valuable at that time. Extension of television outside London, I won't trouble with yet, you know it well. The Vera story is a sad one. You remember the work which was done by research in the development of a tape recording system known as Vera, which was very, very good and had many, many attractions, but we were completely pipped at the coast. At the post, rather, by the development by Ampex of their system in 1957. And I well remember McLean and I, who happened to be in Los Angeles at that time, going up to Redwood City because we heard that there was to be the first demonstration of the Ampex recorder, and we were there at that time. And it really was an eye-opener. Well, my conclusion is this. It's just 40 years of engineering. It's been... In my period of time, and of course lots of things have happened since then, it was a combined effort. Particularly, of course, Eckersley, to whose memory I pay the greatest tribute, and then, of course, to Ashbridge and Kirk and McCarty, Wynne, Wilson, Ransom, Hayes, and countless others. And the parts played by research, development, design, O&M, it's really impossible to divide. I think the three points to me stand out. One, that in all these years, we had the highest engineering standards at all times. We didn't let up, I think it's true to say, really intentionally at any time, unless we were forced to by circumstances outside our control. The second thing was the enormous spirit of cooperation between some of the chaps that I've mentioned and many that I haven't mentioned, which I'm sure has been maintained by my successors. An interesting fact, I was at a dinner the other night and I sat next to a very senior, I won't tell you his name, a very senior civil service engineer, radio engineer, in fact the most senior. And he just turned to me during dinner and said, well, why is it that the BBC's record in the engineering field has been so good? He said, I've been to America, I've been to Japan, I've been everywhere, and they don't hold a candle to the BBC. And I said, well, I don't know. I think it is the cooperation that we've always had these standards which we've tried to maintain. But it was interesting coming from a man who many of you know very well, and that was the impression that he had. And that reputation, I think, of the BBC, blowing our own trumpet a bit, I must admit, is an international one as well. And the third thing, the very high level of skill and initiative and real engineering ability of not only the senior staff, but the middle staff and the junior staff of all grades that have been running the BBC for so many years. Thank you very much. I'm so sorry I've gone past my time.
I'd like to call upon Mr. Weigold to propose a vote of thanks.
Mr. Harold, it's absolutely delightful to see you looking so very, very well and to have you here in this room in which you have spoken and been so often before. It's absolutely splendid. And we do thank you very much indeed for coming along and giving us such an absolutely fascinating talk. To have lived through this and to have been at the centre and to have been an originator in so much pioneering history and to have recaptured it and brought it back to us is a great privilege to us. Now, we are most grateful to you for coming along and we've had the most enjoyable evening and we do thank you very, very much indeed. This splendid pioneering is an absolute inspiration and it's gone on. All through your period, it always seemed to be pioneering in new directions in the BBC, and I think it still will go on. And we are grateful for your lead in this respect. Thank you, Sir Harold, very much.
Mr. Weigel, ladies and gentlemen, it's very kind of you to say all these nice things. I was very appreciative of this invitation to come here. I have, needless to say, a great affection for this building, this room, and all the people that live and work here. And I was very glad indeed to be able to come along and talk in this way. I'm very grateful to you for all you said. Thank you.